From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to Soundings. 200 years ago, between May and September 1787, 55 delegates met in Philadelphia to prepare for the signing of the American Constitution. One of their central concerns was the protection of religious rights in the new nation. Ultimately, these concerns were addressed with the adoption of a series of amendments, or Bill of Rights, in 1791. In part, the First Amendment stipulates that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. In 1987, the relationship between church and state remains a central concern in America. As part of a continuing series of discussions on the bicentennial of the Constitution, Soundings this week examines freedom of religion in the United States. My guest is John Somanchi of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. John Somanchi is the author of Religion and Constitutional Government in the United States, published by Signal Books.
Well, it seems to me this is a very fundamental question that is too often neglected by those who would readily enter into the fray of debating current issues. It seems on the left, the strict separationists would argue that religion was of relatively minor importance. Those on the religious right would, on the other hand, say religion was very important, and then perhaps minimalize or provincialize the type of influence they thought religion had on the shaping of the history.
But we've got people who are talking past one another.
That's true.
They're not really listening, I suppose, very carefully.
Well, again, from the very beginning, there were Christians who felt that the Constitution neglected any type of reference or any type of indebtedness to the Creator. And in juxtaposition with the absence of substantial religious reference in the Constitution, they cited the Declaration of Independence, the work of Jefferson, who talked very much in deistic terms about the Creator, and said that was much more acceptable to them than a Constitution which seemed to acknowledge very little the relationship of the nation to God and His blessings upon these people. So very early, really, after the adoption, in fact, during the ratification controversy, certain Christian groups felt that they wanted to modify the essential text, either by putting into the preamble of the Constitution or elsewhere, that this was a nation under God, and that that formal acknowledgement would satisfy what they felt was a very important symbolic dimension that was absent from what very quickly became a very fundamental and important symbol of the new American nation. Now, such Christian groups have been active from the beginning up to the present.
So this is nothing new.
No, I guess what is new is perhaps the emphasis upon their activity, and what seems to be a larger part of the population being willing to follow that type of leadership. But as early as the first operation of government under the Constitution, you had these Christian groups lobbying for various things. Sunday mail delivery, when the mails were delivered 7 days a week, or the closing of certain exhibitions that were sponsored by the federal government on the Christian day of rest, which was Sunday, and or the placing of In God We Trust on our coins, which was a product of the post-Civil War period that we are still heirs to today. On the other hand, there are certain contributions that became contributions that lost their sort of religious connection and became positive benefits of the secular society, such as the abolition of slavery. The abolition movement is very much associated with northern churches. One way to make sense of that distinction, though certain Christian thinkers have said that the dichotomy is a little unfair, but I think it is illustrative that there are those who are soul savers, those who would impose upon man what they know is good for him.
Yeah, we've got the
against
answers.
His will or with his will.
Mm-hmm.
And there are the body and mind and will savers who say man should be able to choose his own path, whether it is to hell or heaven, and are intent then upon creating an environment, a secular environment, or an environment of this life in which that individual can make meaningful choices.
Mm-hmm.
And that type of dichotomy, I mean, Christian thinkers will say, well, you can't separate soul salvation from mind, body, and will salvation. But I think in certain activities, we can see that people are intent, whether it's a matter of preventing people from having abortions because of a healthy Christian respect for the life and being. The idea is it shouldn't be your choice as the pregnant individual, but we should impose upon you what we feel is the desirable social choice.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, you have the concern for, in many instances, of improving certain opportunities, social and economic change in society, supported by a church that sees its obligation beyond the after, before the afterlife, in terms of improvements in the society as a whole,
the
to save people from
now.
Poverty,
right.
To give them the opportunity, really, to make meaningful choices for themselves.
Jack Samachi, we're talking about religion and government in America. Tell me about how, at the time of the formulation of the religion clauses of the First Amendment, be specific for me. Tell me a couple of historical stories here. Name some names. How did the framers, how did people who spoke for the populist newspapers, that sort of thing, what was the discussion like about this separation between church and state? Characterize the debate for me.
Well, the debate began with the original text of the Constitution in 1787 as it was sent to the states in specially convened ratifying conventions to pass judgment upon the work of the people at Philadelphia 200 years ago. One of the complaints, and one of the quite legitimate complaints, was that there seemed to be no assurance in the document that this new government, which obviously would have powers that were more substantial than the government that was being supplanted, would not infringe upon the rights of the people. So the protection of an individual's freedom of religious choice and the freedom to exercise his or her religion was a part of a much larger desire to protect individual rights. It was an extremely important, fundamental right, but it was part of a total parcel which involved the right to freely assemble, the right to free speech, the right to a jury trial, the right to protect yourself against forced incrimination. And we could go down that whole list, but it's important to realize that it was the dissatisfaction at this particular point, we're talking about 1787, 1788, with opponents of the Constitution who were opponents in part because of a failure to restrict this new enlarged government by imposing certain protections in favor of the individual.
So the religion debate here was not, it was important by itself, but it was also symptomatic of larger political and, I don't know if we'd call them ideological issues, but tensions that were in the air.
That's true, and I think that's extremely important to realize. It's a time in our history where the protection of an individual's right becomes a central focus. And even though it would take, in some cases, hundreds of years before we would get practical legal decisions supporting particular rights, the establishment of those rights, the writing down of those rights in some type of formal document, was a lasting and important and significant contribution of the latter part of the 18th century. So we had a constitution that went into effect in 1789 without a Bill of Rights. The only mention of religion in the original document was the abolition of religious tests for office. Many states retained those tests that you had to profess to be a Christian, which eliminated Jews, or you had to profess to believe in Jesus Christ, which eliminated Catholics and Jews, and obviously others as well. But in that was the only mention in the original text of the Constitution. James Madison was an important figure not only in the drafting of the Constitution, but in gaining its ratification in the state of Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
Madison always said, it isn't necessary to restrict the federal government in favor of these individual rights because this new government we have created is one of delegated powers. And nowhere does it say here that the federal government can interfere with the right of free speech, that it can indeed impose any type of religious views, that it can establish any church. There is no basis for assuming that that type of power can be read into a series of delegations that clearly exclude trampling upon these individual rights. Well, what Madison found in Virginia was that some of his very prominent colleagues in the Virginia legislature felt differently and felt that it was necessary to have a Bill of Rights which would limit the mm-hmm. federal government.
Who was on the other side of that
Patrick issue? Patrick Henry, perhaps the most prominent. Patrick Henry, indeed, had been appointed as a delegate to the Federal Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And he said that he smelled a rat and declined the invitation.
Uh-huh.
So when that document was presented to the Virginia legislature, Patrick Henry was there fighting against it because mm-hmm. it did seem to consolidate government in a way that had not been consolidated under the preceding Articles of Confederation. So that we had... And this poses a certain historical problem. We had many instances in the 1790s, in the early part of the 19th century, where government seemed to be doing things that were generally supportive of religion, not on a preferential basis, although you might say certainly they weren't supporting minor sects, they weren't supporting to a large extent the Jewish population, except mm-hmm. Indirectly. Where people were not measuring that against, well, what does the First Amendment really mean? That whole matter of holding action to the constitutional standard, it's a much later development. And to a large extent, Madison in the 1830s, in his later years, is for the first time doing that himself. Now, here is the person who is framing that amendment. To a large extent, using that amendment or using his later years to think back upon the relationship between that amendment and certain action.
Well, now, what are these later developments that you mentioned that essentially move the issue, the conflict, into the forefront? I'm tempted to say, is it something like television? I mean, in the sense of one group of people trying to make its message more, you know, palpable to large segments of the population. How exactly did the conflict as we see it today evolve through the 19th century between, not between church and state, but the issue of church and state?
Well, the first time we get a direct issue presented, a substantial issue, is when the United States government is confronting the territory of Utah and the Mormons.
Uh-huh. Over the issue of polygamy.
Over the issue of polygamy. And the argument of the Mormons is that polygamy is commanded by their religious faith.
Yep.
And if the First Amendment forbids Congress from abridging the free exercise of religion, then isn't Congress clearly off base in regard to that standard in attempting to suppress the institution of polygamy? The court, in looking at that, essentially says we don't really give much credence to the free exercise claim, primarily because free exercise of religion never meant that you had a right to violate existing civil and criminal law. So they argued essentially that free exercise of religion meant that you could do whatever you wanted within the confines of the general operation of the law. And since it was a criminal offense to marry more than one wife,
indeed,
then the court had no difficulty.
Mm-hmm.
And to a degree, it's a very interesting initial decision, because it's difficult to find among those who are arguing for the widest free exercise of religion much argument with the basic proposition that That free exercise does not condone mm-hmm. an exception, really, from the operation of the valid civil law.
Well, what makes, I want to be careful in my phrasing here, what makes the believers, as it were, uncomfortable is the notion that there is some sort of an implicit surrender here to the primacy of the secular authority first.
I think that's true. In other words, long ago, Roger Williams, one of the champions mm-hmm. for the independent, the free exercise of religion, accepted the fact that as you're living in a secular society, you have the obligation as a religious person to obey the dictates of that society.
Yeah.
And that there was no excuse that those dictates conflicted with your religious feelings or religious duties. And so the idea of rendering unto Caesar what is Caesar's and unto God what is God attracted Roger Williams. The trouble with that is that not only in more contemporary religion, but certainly we can find instances going back well into history, that there are people who have felt religion could not be compartmentalized in that particular way.
It's all of your life.
That the commitment required an overflowing of those categories that mm-hmm. to a large extent made sense only if you neglected the experience or you ignored the type of experience that the truly religiously motivated have felt.
Well, if we look at the history of the United States, Jack Cimaci, we're talking here about religion and government, and we define the relationship between church and state in strictly legal terms, then we can't say that this is any kind of a believing nation, whether regardless of the adjective that we use. How do we get this notion today? How is it that we hear on radio and television that is to say from special interest groups as well as what the most secular of cultural critics that we live in a quote Christian nation. Help tease that one out for me a little bit.
Well, it seems that at the outset, despite the low number of church members,
mm-hmm.
there was a Christian consensus. There was a Protestant consensus.
It was a context,
and it wasn't a context that necessarily made life uncomfortable. For instance, for Jews,
although there are probably some historians of Jewish life in America who would tell you that there were some uncomfortable times.
Oh, no question about it. Yeah. But for instance, Jewish congregations responded very enthusiastically to the presidency of George Washington, sent him letters of congratulation.
How come?
Primarily because of his heading a government under a constitution that abolished religious tests uh-huh. for office. And secondly, the way in which Washington began a practice that is continued up to the present day by Ronald Reagan of talking generally in spiritual terms, attempting to avoid any type of sectarian provincialism.
Mm-hmm.
So that to a degree, we do have and have had a civil religion that abstracts from a number of religions, although it has certain Christian overtones, that the vast majority of the American people continue to pay a degree of allegiance to. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily, and very rarely does it present a choice. You can either be an Episcopalian or you can be a member of the civil religion of the United States.
Yeah.
It can exist and does exist quite harmoniously with that. So that when we hear a president appealing to God to shower his blessings upon the nation in time of crisis, that's a very old tradition that was begun with Washington
uh-huh.
that was avoided by a few presidents who felt uncomfortable with it, including Jackson and Jefferson,
mm-hmm.
but has been followed by most presidents and certainly not in any way seen as being incompatible with the First Amendment bar.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a confusion between this being a Christian nation and this being a nation that has incorporated within its life certain usable religious traditions. So that's why a Ronald Reagan and
yeah.
a George Washington are united in the sense that they can refer to God, they can refer to the adversary, the Soviet Union, as an empire of evil with Christian overtones.
Yeah.
They can talk about atheistic communism and imply the contrast between theistic democracy.
Yeah.
So that, Yes, I would say that our history is a dramatic illustration of how both religion and government can be better, can be more effective, and can exist well together without that commingling mm-hmm. that has characterized earlier times. Mm-hmm. And that in many ways, the framers of the Constitution, I think, would be disturbed with our contemporary situation. If you could have asked them or asked a number of prominent individuals what you hope will be accomplished by separating church and state, their idea would be that it would reduce conflict,
yeah.
and that it would in part promote the religious activity on one hand and save the government from that type of squabble and that type of bitterness.
I think they would be
somewhat disturbed yeah. in looking at a situation where religion has become become involved in politics.
Yeah.
In a very active and somewhat disturbing way because of the opposition that is generated. In other words, that's that tension, it's that squabble, it's that bitterness
yeah.
that I think the hope was we could put this behind us.
Jack Samanchi, tell me about the relationship between the federal government and the states with respect to the exercise of free religion, figuring out what the government, however you want to characterize that, can tell individuals to do by way of what, federal decree and by way of the relationship of the individual to the separate states.
Well, it's fairly clear that initially in 1791, when the First Amendment was added to the federal constitution, that it had no bearing and it restricted no state action mm-hmm. regarding religion.
So it was just some sort of a theoretical thing off there existing in the political haze?
Well, in the sense that the federal government did not take action that led to challenge under the First Amendment, it did tend to sort of stay there for a while.
Yeah.
What gave it prominence was the gradual movement of its protective value to the states through Supreme Court interpretation.
I see.
And this comes about as a result of the end of the Civil War, the addition of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, which was designed to do a number of things. One, to make sure that the states could never take it into their head as collective entities to secede again, and to establish new power that had not existed prior to the Civil War in the federal government. This comes back to church-state in the sense that part of the motivation behind that wording comes from a few members, Bingham in the House of Representatives and Howard in the Senate, who felt that one of the problems was that the protections of individual rights written in the federal constitution were not applicable to the states. There mm-hmm. weren't national standards in this area. And both of those members in their respective houses of Congress argued that their purpose was to make the Bill of Rights applicable to the states.
I see.
Now, for the next 60 years, only one justice of the Supreme Court took the position that in fact, had been done. The other 30 or so colleagues that he served with over that long period of time said nonsense.
Who was this?
This was the first John Marshall Harlan,
mm-hmm.
The justice that we associate with the dissent in Plessy versus Ferguson.
I see.
But he was the only justice that argued that the 14th Amendment had, by its terminology, made the Federal Bill of Rights applicable to the states. The rest of the court did not buy that. But eventually in 1925, in part as a result of the wartime activities that limited free speech, the court increasingly got involved in free speech cases. And in 1925, it said, the First Amendment's free speech clause is a limitation upon what the states can do.
Mm-hmm.
Beginning in 1925...
It comes that late in our history.
Right. Beginning in 1925, the process began over the next 44 years, making most of the substantial guarantees of the Bill of Rights binding on the states. Mm-hmm. In regard to the religion clauses, we get an inkling of this in 1932... Then we get a clear enunciation of it in 1940, in regard to free exercise, the free exercise claim, and then in 1947 in regard to the establishment claim. So if we look at the controversy which has been generated by the application of these new national standards to state action, that's a 40-year history at most. So that when we look at things like school prayer, why can't 99% of the people in a school district decide that their children begin the morning with a prayer?
Mm-hmm.
They could before 1962, in the case of Engel versus Vitale. Why can't they now? The idea, of course, is that the religion clauses of the First Amendment made applicable to the states through the broad wording of the first section of the 14th Amendment see this as a law respecting an establishment of religion and therefore in violation
and prohibited.
Of the 14th Amendment, which brings in that clause in the First Amendment. And so that when Senator Jesse Helms comes along and says we need an amendment to the Constitution permitting school prayer,
that's what he's got in mind.
It's because the Supreme Court has spoken in 1962 saying the present Constitution requires the states to eliminate school prayer in the way in which their school exercises are conducted.
Mm-hmm.
So that part of it is a nationalizing of standards and a shifting of central concern from a shifting of concern to a central power. So that to a large extent, states were quite free to do what they wanted until, in regard to religion, until the 1940s. And this change is the change that has really spurred. In other words, we say, well, why have the last 40 years produced all this visibility? In part because if we restricted ourselves specifically to what the federal government is doing, we'd still have a handful of cases.
Yeah.
If we can look at now 50 states and what they're doing, hundreds of cases are being generated.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a discussion about religion and government in America. My guest was John Samanchi of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. John Samanchi is the author of Religion and Constitutional Government in the United States, published by Signal Books. In the weeks to come, Soundings will present other discussions on topics related to the bicentennial of the American Constitution. For a cassette copy of Soundings on Religion and Government in the United States, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings would like to hear from you. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, the topic will be law, community, and political conflict. My guest will be Gerald Postema of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Listen to Soundings. This is Kim Nielsen at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join Wayne Pond this week for a discussion about religion and government in the United States. Wayne's guest is John Samanchi of the University of North Carolina. Church, State, and Religious Freedom in America, another in a series of programs about the bicentennial of the American Constitution, this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.